Welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. This is the podcast where we explore the people and stories that make up the tech and venture ecosystem. Don't forget to subscribe, like, rate, and share the podcast because it really helps us get the word out to more people who are curious about understanding even more about the world of venture capital. This season of Nothing Ventured is sponsored by Odin. Odin helps angels, VCs, and founders to raise and deploy capital seamlessly. You can structure your SPVs and now run your funds, handle capital calls, portfolio management more smoothly and easily in one place. Founders use Odin to raise their entire round in a few clicks by simply sending investors a link and receiving investments immediately. Odin works with over 5,000 investors and over 150 emerging fund managers and angel syndicates globally. Head to joinodin.com to learn more. That's joinodin.com. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I was super excited to have with me in the studio Sam Benny. Sam is the founder of Platin, a platform that reimagines networking with advanced AI that curates your connections for meaning and value, unlocking networking's full potential. Prior to founding Platin, Sam was head of innovation at TechNation and had founded and exited multiple deep tech ventures. In today's episode, we talked about leaving Iran and being without status here in the UK for 4 years. The reality of entrepreneurship, Sam living on his office couch for 3 years. We talk about complex AI, the convergence of complex systems or complexity in systems and AI, and has OpenAI killed the internet? Finally, we talked about separating the social from social media at Platin. Let's get straight into it. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I have with me in the studio, Sam Benny. If you haven't had the chance yet, do check out our primer episode where Sam talks a little bit about his background and some of the stuff that's really exciting him at the moment. But we are going to get into a bit of the detail that we didn't discuss in that primer episode right now. But for the time being, Sam, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited.
Amazing. Well, look, we're going to dive straight in, and I appreciate this is probably quite a difficult topic, but you've had an incredible and non-traditional background, right? Having come to the UK essentially as a refugee. Can you talk us through your experience and how that has informed your journey into venture and all the things that you've done thereafter?
Of course. For various reasons, unfortunately, I had to flee my homeland, where I was born in Iran. And I came to UK alone when I was 17, illegally. As an asylum seeker, right? And so I...
Just to clarify, the routes you came down were illegal. You yourself were not illegal.
Well, it's a gray area.
Well, it depends if you're talking to Suella Braverman.
Exactly.
Or not, right?
If you're speaking to the government, they would see it differently.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I have applied for asylum upon my arrival. Mm-hmm. And I was 17. Wow. 17. I came to UK alone and applied for asylum. And here I was in the UK, and I had to figure out kind of what's next. And I was quite proud of myself, quite frankly, because I didn't believe that I should ask for help, because although the government supports individuals who come this way, but I never ask for it, to be honest with you, because I was quite proud that I don't want that, right? However, because of overall, like the legal situation that exists, usually they should kind of like give you a response around your asylum case around 6 months. Mm-hmm. And mine, although I didn't know it at the time, I've got a hindsight now, took over almost 4 years.
Wow.
So what that means is that for 4 years, I couldn't open a bank account. I couldn't study. I couldn't work. Nothing. Mm. So I, for all purposes, I didn't exist.
Yeah.
So for lack of better option, although I was lucky, and I always say this, it's not my skills, it's not my privilege in any shape or form. I was just lucky, right? Someone else in my shoes, if they didn't have access to some entrepreneurs, which I would say, you know, there is a higher chance for me to sit here with you talking about AI and futurology than actually when you go down, serve your kebab in a kebab shop, to be honest with you.
Sure.
But in this case, what has changed for me was that, a friend of mine who I was quite connected over the internet, believe it or not, actually doing some philosophy course, called me and said, like, he knows about my situations. Shout out to Ash, who became my first co-founder. He called me and said, like, hey, I know your situation, Sam. I'm thinking to start a tech company. Would you like to move in to Birmingham and, I'll be custodian of your shares and we start this company together?
Wow.
And I said, dude, I have no other option. I can't do anything. Whatever, I'm in. Right. So I moved to Birmingham to start this, you know, sleeping on his couch.
Wow.
And him being custodian of my shares. And we started Weblog, which was kind of like Pi to AWS, really blew up, which was web infrastructure providing VPS to SMEs,
yeah,
building their applications and so on. And it worked out. You know, we hired several developers and engineers, and I was a kind of a young entrepreneur without a visa, without any
without
paperwork,
anything, yeah,
without a bank. Although I was working in my own company, although I didn't have any shares because my shares were kind of like owned by my co-founder.
So, apart from anything else, just a huge amount of trust, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I did not have any other option.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. But shout out to Ash, who's an amazing founder now. He's running his own fintech right now. And so we started this company together, and it was a great experience with a third co-founder who was finishing his PhD in University of Birmingham. And I learned more and more about entrepreneurship, about engineering, about developers. You know, I suddenly found myself managing the developers, and I didn't know whether they're lying to me or not. They're delaying because they say something, so I had to learn programming, coding, stuff like that to be able to manage them. And that was my journey into entrepreneurship.
And so talk me through kind of how you then kind of came through the Asylum system, right?
Yeah,
because
sure,
presumably you're doing all of this stuff. To your point, you're having to do it not under the radar, but you're having to do it in a way that doesn't breach the terms of your status, right?
Of course.
But that could have been, like, given the stories that we hear today, could have just been an ongoing situation for, and you know, to your point, 4 years is already remarkable, but could have even lasted longer. So talk me through how you passed through the system and kind of the feeling and the sentiment that you had once that happened.
Of course. Just to update for that first venture, right? We decided to kind of move on and started kind of another venture around renewable energy. We were too early, right? This is not kind of like the green revolution we're living right now. We're talking about a decade ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really was a slow death of that company. I ended up sleeping in my office on the couch for 3 years.
Wow.
And during that moment, you know, I said, like, enough is enough. So kind of like through some advice and through discussion with lawyers, decided to sue the UK government, believe it or not.
Oh, my God. Okay. Let's get into that. Yeah.
And I won in the courts. So they had 2 weeks to give me the positive kind of like.
But could they not? Could that not have backfired on you? Could they?
Oh, yeah, of course. They could decline and yeah. I should have been forcibly removed and deported to a country that most likely would have had severe consequences on me.
Wow.
Which I'm unfortunately unable to get in. And it could have backfired for sure, right? But I didn't have any other option again. And in this case, I pushed forward and it worked. Fortunately, I arrived there, and believe it or not, actually, which was quite interesting, I remember going to the court, and the Home Office lawyers, the main lawyer of the Home Office, the gentleman was blind, so he couldn't read the documents I provided because it was in part to be able to read it. So therefore, the whole court kind of like lasted maybe 4 minutes.
Wow.
Because no information could be provided. And after 2 weeks, I received my refugee status.
Amazing. And so you are now a fully fledged sort of British citizen, or?
Oh, yeah. So that was a while ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So after living here almost 12 years, last year I got my British citizenship. So I'm one of the Brits now. So
congratulations.
Thank you very much. Waving the Union Jack. I've got my British passport. Yeah.
I mean, so many thoughts come to mind just, you know, listening to that story. I think you know, we all know that certainly within technology businesses or in venture in general, there are actually lots of stats about outcomes for migrant founders, right? Yeah. In positive outcomes, like in terms of the success of their businesses. And this is often because migrants come with a mentality that entrepreneurship is the only way they can, you know, they can survive, which is exactly, you know, for you was exactly what it was, right? So I don't even know how to put this. Like, do you think had you been granted asylum like day one on arrival in the UK or very shortly thereafter, do you think you would have been pushed down this entrepreneurial path in the same way? Obviously not in the same way, but, you know, with the same sort of, approach that you ended up taking, which was just embrace it wholeheartedly and kind of make it your life. This season of Nothing Ventured is proudly sponsored by Emerge One. Emerge One provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups and scale-ups. They work with businesses from C to Series B that have been backed by some of the UK, US, and Europe's best venture capital funds. They provide support from capital allocation and management, KPIs and reporting, fundraising support, financial modeling, investor relations, and investor management. Come check them out at emergeone.co.uk when you're scaling fast and have need of a CFO.
I think it's a great question, right? Because I think innovation always comes out of frustration.
Yeah.
And in this case, I think entrepreneurship is a form of innovation, right? Mm. Because you find a specific problem and you want to solve it, right? So in this case, if you know, we go back and in a you know, perhaps in multiverse, there's a universe that's being granted kind of like my refugee status upon kind of like after a month or some sort.
Yeah.
Some sort. Probably not. I'll be honest with you, because most likely I would have gone forward with my passion at the time, which was design.
You know? Yeah.
Most likely I would have been a designer of some sort. I became an entrepreneur for lack of better option.
Yeah.
I did not want to follow my father's footsteps, you know, because being an entrepreneur is not easy. You know, I mean, I know he's romanticized, especially in, you know, recent years. When we started, that was not the case, you know, when we started.
Especially in Birmingham, you're in the office 3 years sleeping on a couch. That is not a story that you hear much of in the UK, for sure.
Quite frankly, that was not the case when we started our first company, right? We heard it so many times, people saying that, like, you know, you guys have started this company because you couldn't find a job. You know, that was the mentality.
Yeah. And to be honest, it still is a little bit here in the UK. We don't treat entrepreneurship with the same gusto that they do in the US, right? Like in the US, it's a badge of honor to be a founder, to be an entrepreneur. It's even a badge of honor, you know, if you found a company, try and scale it and fail. Like, people don't look down on you. In fact, if anything, they see that as like, okay, this person has learned and has grown and has, you know, navigated situations where many people won't have. Whereas in the UK, I think, you know, there's still this massive stigma around failure, and especially business failure, right? Even if you look at the press, and, you know, sadly, and we'll get on to Tech Nation in a second, but, you know, when Tech Nation went under, there was a lot of negative press around that. But equally, when you think about things like the Future Fund, which, you know, was a really massive, like, for as much as I try and be as apolitical as possible, but I don't love the current government, but I think some of the stuff that they've done, especially during the pandemic, was really valuable. I think the Future Fund, you know, without it, we'd have seen a lot more businesses go to the wall a lot quicker. And I think it's really frustrating to see, you know, stuff in the press, like, you know, government has spaffed 100 million or whatever the number is of taxpayer monies up the wall, because the reality is that, again, venture doesn't work like that, right? It's the outliers that pay for everything, right? And if you've just got one or two, or, you know, maybe half a dozen of those outliers in that portfolio, it more than makes up for all the losses elsewhere. But here in the UK, we just don't have that.
I think it's the problem, the mentality. Yeah. I'm totally with you, right? The mindset, quite frankly, you know, because when I speak to investors, and compare the investors, especially in the Europe or UK, to American ones, right? In the US, when you pitch, they want to see how big you can go, right? What is the upside for them, right? Here is all about like managing risks. It's like, but what if this happens? What, I mean, that's not how it works in technology, entrepreneurship, you know, that doesn't work like that. However, that's the mentality. And I think the problem here is that because we had a late start, quite frankly, with you, because US, that was the mentality of entrepreneurship long before.
From the 60s onwards,
yeah. And here is just quite recent, right? And, you know, just a decade ago, we had only six unicorns, right? And now we've got 145 of them.
Yeah.
But again, it was a decade ago, only six. Mm. And the key question is that what has changed? I think the change is that those people who exited became, you know, operators and then got into VCs and so on. But historically, who are the VCs that are non-operators?
They're money managers, yeah.
They're money managers, bankers, consultants. Mm-hmm. And they've never, ever been in the trenches of entrepreneurship. And, you know, I mean, I don't have the expectation for them to understand it, to be honest. So what they do, they bring the same mentality of risk management to the venture, which doesn't work, quite frankly.
It's contrary to the way venture should work. Venture is not about minimizing risk, it's about maximizing upside, right? So let's switch tack for a second. Thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm sure it's not easy. I'm sure you've talked about it many times as well, though.
Believe it or not, I didn't say it. Even some of my co-founders and recent co-founders didn't know up until kind of like I got my British citizenship, which I was like, I think it's probably the time. And I posted it on LinkedIn, and to my surprise, I think like 300,000 people seen it, and so it's just crazy, blown up.
I mean, I met you, I think, three, maybe 4 months ago. I think it was just before summer. I think within the first hour, I think I probably knew that about you. So thank you so much for sharing it. And look, I mean, I think, you know, these are the stories that should be inspiring for people, right? Like, so if you are a 17-year-old refugee, asylum status, can't work, can't study, can't earn a living, you know, people who sit there and say, I can't do it, you can. You've just got to figure out the right way for you. And yes, it will be hard. No one says entrepreneurship is easy. No. It is bloody hard. You know, those of us that have been through the mill, I think, recognize the difficulty. Some of us wear scars as a result of it. Some of us have come out the other side stronger maybe for it. But, you know, there is no, I think, experience like founding your own business, but you have to be able to back yourself, right? You have to be able to take the time to really think about what you want for yourself and make it happen. And I think, you know, obviously to some extent it was forced upon you, but it's unleashed the whole history of your last, you know, decade as a result. You know, you've created CBDCs for central governments and God knows what else. Maybe we shouldn't talk too much about that, but you know, you've done a lot of stuff. So changing tack, like you were at Tech Nation, right? Which is, it's also a big deal. You're the head of innovation there. So, but you were there when they lost their funding from the government, right? Yes. Which I think a lot of us in the tech and venture community were shocked at. I think we were even more shocked by the fact that, you know, that funding was then given to a commercial entity. I have no idea whether Barclays and Eagle Labs will do, you know, would do the right thing, the wrong thing. I have no judgment on them, but you know, one would have to expect that a commercial entity will work very different from an organization like Tech Nation, which was really just sort of a for public good kind of organization. And you know, part of the problem there was the fact that there was no other source of funding. Therefore, it was a very swift kind of decline. But can you talk us through, as much as you're able to, what happened from your perspective and then the outcomes that we've seen since? And how do you see government policy shaping the future of tech in the UK? And here I'm thinking about things like visa programs, what they've done to R&D of late, then also the SEI, SEIS regimes. I'd love to get your perspective, having kind of been in Tech Nation and seen that really, you know, from the ground up.
Of course, I still believe that was a wrong decision by the UK government. And as you mentioned, because Tech Nation was built by a UK government for that specific reason, right? A non-profit organization. And yet, making that decision, I think it was a wrong decision personally. But yet we are here and we are in the consequences of that. But I have to give a massive, massive shout out to all the ex-Tech Nationers. Making, you know, today's UK tech possible, really, for the past decades, you know, whether it was a tech city or later on became Tech Nation. With their help, you know, with their support, with their building this ecosystem of peer-to-peer network, we've got these amazing founders coming back again and again, right? So huge, huge shout out to them. But the good news is that Tech Nation, at least the brand of Tech Nation, is not dead. So Tech Nation 2.0 is coming back.
Yeah, it was bought out by Brent Hoveman and Founders Forum and his organization. Yeah,
not to the same extent of power that Tech Nation was, but it's coming back and still supports the founders. I think the good news for the founders in this case is that they have more options, right? Although it's not as centralized as Tech Nation was, to be able to support the founders, but they've got more options when it comes to, as you mentioned, Barclays Eagle Labs, or for example, TechNation 2.0, or other perhaps supportive organizations for the entrepreneurs, which is always good.
Yeah.
However, what happened specifically during the time of TechNation, it was quite an experience, I have to say, because the last thing I thought was that TechNation will go down. I don't think
any of us expected that to happen.
I did not. In fact, I went on hiring teams towards the end of last year, giving them hope that this is just going to pass. You know, we're going to move forward and selling the vision. And, you know, I felt responsible afterwards of selling a vision of something that I didn't know that would go down. Right?
So, and in fact, let's dig into that for a second, because I think you've mentioned this to me in the past. Like, it wasn't very transparent what happened. Like, as in, you got the news when everyone got the news, right? There was no sort of warning. There was no lead up or build up that suggested that this was going to happen.
I think we all learned at TechNation on the same day that the news was given to the public. It's unfortunate what has happened. But the good news is that TechNation soul, the overall spirit is alive. Mm-hmm. Within the founders themselves, as I've graduated, I received thousands of messages from TechNation alums and ecosystem players, you know, supporting and saying like they would like to carry on, you know, the mission of TechNation, as well as TechNation on their founders forum leadership that is being led. I think that's a positive outcome out of what has happened, quite frankly. Yeah. I mean, I would say what would be even more positive if that the whole thing didn't happen.
Hadn't have happened in the process, yeah.
But sure. Yeah, at the end of the day, you know, we are in this situation, right? Mm-hmm. I think there were some misunderstanding in decision makers within the UK government. Mm-hmm. I personally believe that, you know, the problem, I think this is, again, I have to repeat it multiple times.
You're not speaking on behalf of TechNation or anyone else.
I'm not talking on behalf of
very
anyone.
Much your personal opinion.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Few decision makers in the UK government have absolutely no idea what scale-up is.
Mm.
They either think startups with one or two people in it or corporates with thousands of people.
They don't know what they...
They have no idea what's in the middle. Mm. And majority of the companies are in the middle. And those are the people that need help, right? And they have no idea how it works. Absolutely no idea. And that was a problem.
So taking kind of a lead from that, because I have lots of thoughts about how the UK government has approached sort of these issues. You know, I talked earlier about how great it was that we had the Future Fund that was set up, which actually, you know, was spearheaded by Brent originally and Dom Hallis and others. But, you know, we've equally seen, you know, this sort of almost, you know, just... I can't even describe it, but you know, the chopping of R&D funding or the R&D tax credit rather, which I appreciate the rationale of there being, you know, fraudulent activity or, you know, potentially fraudulent claims being made. I don't think it was as high as maybe was purported to be, or rather the numbers may have been big, but the actual number of kind of fraudulent claims was probably not that big. I think the problem is it was like we'll take an axe to everything. We'll cut the knees out of everyone rather than just targeting the perpetrators. So again, that to me stifles innovation. Like a lot of businesses, you know, we work with obviously a lot of startups and scale ups in my business. You know, that R&D for a lot of them, it not a lifeline, but it's often, you know, it's something that you kept up your sleeve, your back pocket, so that, you know, you always knew that there was a bit of additional runway to kind of make things better. It feels like that's a very heavy-handed approach. I think the SEIS, loosening the SEIS rules, or not loosening, but, you know, increasing the allocation is great. And equally, you know, some of the rules around now pensions being able to allocate more into venture, again, great, but it just feels like there isn't a coherent policy around tech and venture in this country. And then, you know, we've had people like Neil Shah on from the London Stock Exchange Group, and then, you know, others like Hussein Kanji, who are vehemently kind of, you know, in no way, shape or form are they anti kind of the London Stock Exchange or anything like that, but they just don't believe that here in the UK and Europe, we're set up for success in the same way as the US. So this is why we see so many of our companies, you know, decamping, heading over to the US and listing, because the rules and equally the mentality, I think, of a lot of the pools of capital here is just not there to support tech businesses. So I guess, I don't know what my question really is, but I think maybe what I'm trying to ask is, do you think that the government, certainly at the moment, is showing a, you know, is it showing that they have an understanding of and the interests of this sort of the tech ecosystem in mind, or do you think it's sort of a bit haphazard?
I think they are going in the right direction, to be honest with you, because forever we had this situation of tech in the UK government being divided between two different ministries, yeah. DCMS and BASE.
Yeah.
That was a huge, huge headache for everyone, right? And they fixed it, which is great. And to be honest, I think Minister George Freeman is the only, as far as I know, is the only minister that has ever, from a background of venture, that got into politics, actually.
Other than maybe Rishi Sunak, I mean, sort of. Maybe, yeah. Kind of, ish.
Ish.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this is a good progress, mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm. Is it enough? I mean, when it comes to politics, it's never enough.
Never enough, yeah.
But is a good direction. I think it was the right decision to be able to combine those two ministries together. And we are moving towards the right direction. I think especially like building up a new office for quantum technologies is the right decision. Having, you know, a strengthening office for AI is the right decision. These are right decisions, right? To make UK the superpower of science and innovation. These are definitely the right decisions. However, there are some wrong decisions, as always with politics. Again, you know, we talk about some of the, I think this is something that goes behind page 2, page 3 of BBC most likely. But one of the things that is being discussed quite a lot is the online safety bill.
Yeah.
And the online safety bill, basically, I know I completely understand it from, you know, when it comes to specifics on the safety of individuals. We know that for sure. You know, social media such as Facebook should have been regulated from day one. You know that directly, you know, the suicides of teenagers are directly yep. correlated with
use of social media. Instagram.
Exactly, with Instagram and so on. You know that pedophiles are operating on these social medias. We know all of that. But is the answer completely removing encryption of internet?
No.
I'm not sure.
No.
I think that's not their answer.
Yeah, it's sort of, again, it's a bit like the R&D. It's taking a very heavy-handed approach rather than finding a central ground that maybe resolves it. Again, changing tack now, because I know this is something that you're really passionate about. You are an international speaker on complex AI. Can you talk me through what you mean by that and where things are heading?
Sure. So my previous venture, we combined multi-object optimization with complexity science and artificial intelligence, especially machine learning techniques. I gave a TEDx talk on complex AI, coined the term complex AI, which basically is complexity science plus AI, right, combined together. And what that means is that you have a decentralized AI autonomous agents, right? Mm. So for example, society, we are a complex system. Right.
Yeah.
Internet is a complex system.
Yeah.
That means that you have many, many autonomous decision-maker entities, right? Whether there are like, you know, people mm-hmm. or items or companies, these are all complex systems. Historically, AI been really bad in dealing with complex systems, right? That's why we don't have autonomous vehicles on the road, is because driving is a complex problem. So what complex AI is actually combining complexity science with machine learning, AI techniques, and so on. And that was the specific key point that I mentioned like in 2019. But the problem that we had at the time specifically was that natural language wasn't advanced enough. So you couldn't have a proper human-machine interaction. So you could still like, you know, speaking programming and code and so on. But now with the advancements of LLMs, although we'll dive a bit deeper on why I think about them, I think we've got a really good understanding of how we can actually interact with machines and to be able to deploy them. So that's the kind of extension of complex AI to some extent, because complex AI ultimately is a bridge between narrow AI, which are like, for example, all the services most likely you use from Alexa and so on.
All the chatbots sort of stuff, yeah.
Because you cannot lift and shift them and put them elsewhere, right?
So they're very, very specific to the problem that they are have essentially been built to solve, right?
Absolutely.
And they to some extent you could argue they're not AI because they can't go outside the bounds of what they've been programmed to do to some extent.
Correct. I mean, the term of AI is a very hot topic, and there is that general AI AGI that people talk about, which is in ultimately the sphere of science fiction. Sure. Right, it doesn't exist. And there is that super AI that is even more science fiction, quite frankly.
Yeah, Skynet and Terminator, yeah.
So when it comes to the bridge between the narrow AI to general AI, you have to infuse what actually happens in real world, which we live in a complex environment with complex being in it, right? So in order to do that, you have to infuse complexity into AI systems, right? And that's what complex AI is, which is the bridge between the narrow AI to get to general AI. It's not the general AI, but is the bridge between them.
Right, okay, it's the pathway that you have to tread, which I guess at the moment we're seeing somewhat a lot of in the use of autonomous agents, that are being spawned as a result of ChatGPT, that like right at the beginning when ChatGPT was first kind of made public, you saw a spate of open source projects released on GitHub where you could spin up your own autonomous agents, and then from there, we saw autonomous agents that were spinning up autonomous agents, and you could essentially set a task, which then would be followed through by one or multiple agents without intervention. So it would ask and answer the questions of itself, and then set up agents to solve the problems. Right.
Well, unfortunately, genie is out of the bottle. Right. Yeah. And I should say, like, I blame OpenAI. Quite frankly, I personally believe that OpenAI has killed the internet as we know it.
Wow.
And the reason I say this is because
strong words.
And I will explain why. And the reason is because right now we're seeing the death of internet as we know it. And the reason is because right now with synthetic data, with synthetic information, with synthetic text, images, videos, and so on, without metadata, without actually determining the AI generated, we have infused internet with tons of them. I think there was a scene of data like almost 30% right now.
Oh, so you're talking about essentially disinformation, so deep fakes. And
not just that, yeah. But ultimately this data, yeah, right, being infused into internet.
Got it.
And more, what happens is that the next generation of LLMs, the next generation of AI systems need to be trained on set data.
Yeah.
And guess what? Those trained data are trained on the previous data that is hallucinated. Yeah. Okay. You do that 5 times.
And you just get pure hallucination.
The internet is dead. There is a study actually that is like a photocopier, right? Every time you get a worse kind of like result, right? In this case, we've got 5 more tries and that's it. And we know for a fact that by 2 years' time, 90% of the data would be AI generated.
So potentially corrupt, potentially incorrect.
Absolutely.
Or certainly unidentifiable, right? You can't get back to the source.
We don't know whether it's human generated or it's AI generated.
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. Now that you mentioned it, I'm sort of sat here thinking, okay, well, I can see where the problems arise in that, to say the least. I mean, I was thinking about it very, very narrowly again, in the sense of we're already seeing it with deep fakes, right? Like it is now, one of our previous guests, Bronwyn Williams, sort of mentioned on Twitter, like it's very hard now. You cannot sit there and be opinionated about something online because you don't know whether what you're seeing online is true or not. There is so much opportunity for, fake images to come out. If we think about the war that has erupted over the weekend, we're recording this in mid-October. Last weekend we've seen the atrocities committed by Hamas in Israel and everything that is going to arise out of that. But, you could imagine, even if it hasn't happened, you could imagine that bad actors could essentially use deep faked images to perpetuate whichever cause they want to perpetuate. And it's very hard to then distinguish what is fact from reality. Right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we've seen this in a battlefield, right? So when Russia attacked Ukraine, we've seen videos, fake videos from Zelensky saying that, you know, Ukrainians should put their arms down and so on. So we see that, you know, bad actors are utilizing whatever technology they have available to them, right? So in this case... In this case, having kind of like access to intelligence that can create a very convincing disinformation and misinformation makes their jobs a lot easier, right?
Yeah.
But it's not just that. You know, I think what OpenAI has done is extremely unethical and is going to go down into the history books, quite frankly, with you. But actually releasing that. And now the problem is not they released it. The problem is now it's open source. Anyone can do it. So it's end of the internet
all
as we know
it. API and you're not. There are already there hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people.
There is no way to fix this anymore. Mm. Like the only way I personally believe is the concept of curated internet.
Yes.
That's the only way. And that's what we aim to do at Platin, right? End of the day. Is private curated internet, which is trusted.
Well, let's actually get into that, right? So you're building Platin to create a better social network.
Yeah.
So what is broken about current platforms other than sort of this issue around the you know the AI and what's been happening with OpenAI? And how will Platin change the nature of how we meet and interact with people, do you think?
Very good question. So in case of what's wrong with the current systems, right? So if you look into all social media systems, they are centralized algorithms. Mm-hmm. What that means, I mean, we don't really think about them, but we technically live in a dystopian future if you ask someone in early 2000, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason I say this is because these centralized black box algorithms are making decisions for you without any response from you.
Yeah.
And they feed you anything it wants, right? So they basically are conditioning you to become what the algorithm wants, because that was the easier thing to code than actually ask you what you want.
It strikes me, right? Because I post a lot on LinkedIn, and recently I've been seeing some weird stuff like very low impressions on posts and so on. And exactly to what I realized that I'd gotten locked into a pattern of I must post every day because that will get engagement, which will lead to leads or whatever it might be. And then when that just stopped working in the way that I expected it, my immediate reaction was kind of a visceral, well, there's something broken with the algorithm. All they've done is change the algorithm, right? Like they've just done what is expedient for whatever it is that they are trying to achieve, to exactly your point, right? Like they don't care whether I get leads. What they care is that they maximize, you know, your time on platform.
I think LinkedIn is a great example. I had a call with the LinkedIn team a couple of weeks ago and asked them like, how the algorithm really works, really.
They won't tell me.
And they have no idea.
They don't have any idea. That's what they told me.
So we've got this black box, right, that ultimately make all these decisions, and they give you a dashboard to say like, oh, you have achieved this and that based on no objectives for you to be able to achieve that, right? Yeah. So again, what game am I playing if I don't have any sort of input to it, right? So now in this situation, especially with LinkedIn, which I think I've got my personal opinions about it, I think LinkedIn started for a very good reason, which was to be able to connect individuals in a professional setting. But now everyone agrees that
it's a social platform.
It's becoming Facebook.
Right? It's a social platform.
And not just that, but also the authenticity of human-to-human interaction is dead. Mm. And the reason is because you can now just go on LinkedIn, click on generate message for me, and it just write a message for you and send it to me. If I know that you've done that, right?
I don't feel like you've
why
spent any time.
Would I even look at your message because you just clicked one button and you didn't even write it?
Yeah.
Right?
And so, not only that, I mean, and predating that, you have bots that, I mean, like I'm seeing this on a lot of the posts that I put out. You've now got people replying with clearly what they've done is they've got a chat bot or an AI bot that is essentially looking at your post.
Yeah.
So they've set up, you know, automatically for any post written by this person or containing these keywords, go in, summarize a post, and then spew it back as a comment. And it's so obviously happening.
Actually, believe it or not, Arish, they don't use the third parties. It's a feature on
you
LinkedIn.
You reckon it's an actual LinkedIn?
It's an actual LinkedIn feature, which is crazy.
Well, I mean, what I do know is, like, I recently earned a top entrepreneurship badge, and I had thank you. I had no idea how I earned it. But the reason I earned it was because they've set up a new flow, which is they have what they call community articles. Mm-hmm. So they use AI to generate articles, which then they ask people to comment or to add feedback onto. And when you read these articles, they are everything that's wrong with the ChatGPT world, right? Like, you can tell that they're written by AI. You can tell that they are very superficial, like not deep kind of articles. And of course, what LinkedIn is then doing is getting our knowledge to then retrain those models as they move forward. But yeah, I mean, it's been this noticeable shift in that direction, and it's a very uncomfortable direction for sure.
And to be honest, the spam, right? I received 300 messages. Yeah. 90% of them are spam on a daily basis.
Yeah, yeah. Do you need another R&D, SEO, developer shop in India?
I just don't.
Like,
I don't want any of it.
Yeah, please no.
Yeah. So there are so many issues right now with, you know, the de facto of ultimately online networking, which is LinkedIn, right? It became a data farm, quite frankly. Microsoft, what they've done is amazing, but it's kind of like being data farm for Microsoft at this stage. Sure. So we thought, how can we fix this problem, right? Not just on spamming, not just on kind of connecting people, but democratization and empowering individuals' decision-making, empowering freedom of choice, celebrating differences of individuals. And what we are doing is exactly the opposite of that, right? With LLMs right now, what we do ultimately is combine humanity's knowledge in one centralized system and give you that information on an average to an individual. So there is no personalization.
But this is a problem with technology. I mean, like, I've been saying this for a long time, probably shouting into the void, right? But this is the reality of technology. Technology abstracts away to the average, because that's the only way you can achieve scale. Because the more personalized you get, the harder it is to scale, because you've got to personalize for everyone. Now, if you can do that with AI of some nature, then great.
Exactly.
Which is what I'm sure we're getting to. But for the most part, it's about how do I best fit as many as possible?
That's right.
And the outliers will figure themselves out.
Absolutely. Right. However, with the same technology, you can achieve the other way around, as you mentioned. So I think it's all about empowering individuals to be able to determine their own interests, their own objectives in this case. I think what we've done, especially with social media systems, to be able to ultimately utilize our best knowledge around social psychology and neurology and all of these things into making applications that are super, super addictive, even more addictive than, you know, most of the drugs out there.
Sure.
Because they're driving your dopamine release. What we've done is basically maximizing profit for certain corporations to become bigger and bigger by ultimately creating these very, very addictive systems called social medias, right? I think the way is to separate the social from the media. We believe that at Platin that social interaction are the key and the media is a distraction. And that's what we truly believe. And what we want is to every individual on the platform to be to given power and to be democratized, the decentralized AI to be able to set their own objectives. So you have your own algorithm in this case, not a centralized algorithm.
Yeah. So you are essentially, you are almost creating single node social networks, right?
For every individual.
For every individual.
That's right.
So, without getting into the kind of technical details of this, this feels like something that 3 years ago we'd been talking about with Web3, with kind of DAOs, DAOs, decentralized organizations. What's changed? What is making this possible now?
No, I do agree that I think some people are going to hate me for this, but I think Web3 is just a marketing buzz.
I mean, we've had many investors on this podcast saying exactly the same thing.
It just, there's no such a thing as Web3, quite frankly, with you.
Yeah, Web3, blockchain, and sort of anything that is tokenized is pretty much going to zero.
And they should, quite frankly, most of them. I mean, there are some really good projects out there. But most of them are just, you know, I mean, I asked myself a year and a half ago when the market was booming, I was like, how many people really want, you know, metaverse clothing company and raise 10 million on their first round? Mm-hmm. Like, this just doesn't make sense. And we see the result of that today, right? But in our case, it's different, right? So it's, you know, some people compare us to metaverse. We are not even remotely close. Yes, we are simulation based, but there is no 3D effect. So, you know, we are AI first. In fact, some of the people in academia, they say that we are going after the most bleeding edge of AI research right now. And to solve that problem, we require amazing individuals from across the all great universities in the UK and across the Atlantic to be able to do this. But however, when it comes to the comparison with blockchain-based and Web3-based systems, the difference here is ultimately decentralized artificial intelligence, right? Because what we had previously was like decentralization as an idea through blockchain. But in this case, it's different, right? It's not about you've got kind of a blockchain that, you know, information is stored in a distributed ledger. In this case, is that you've got every node, as you mentioned, kind of like a AI version being kind of built specifically for that user.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there is, I mean, I personally believe there's definitely, we have problems with social networks. I haven't used Facebook for probably about 15 years. Twitter, I kind of come on and leave again every
X.
Yeah, X, sorry. No, but it's still twitter.com. Like, I think they've maybe...
I think they messed up.
I think they changed it back. Maybe Elon maybe got a little bit scared. But like every time I see some other rubbish on there, it just turns me further. And LinkedIn, to your point, like, has become this kind of farm of just inauthentic content and everyone sort of just vying for attention. And I'm probably one of those people. I'm not so proud as to say that I don't use it in ways that satisfy my own goals. But the frustration is very much that the authenticity of connections that you make on LinkedIn are only kind of an inch deep. They aren't very, very, you know, they aren't deep relationships. And I think what it sounds like you're building at Platin is a way to create deeper relationships with people with whom you actually want to have a relationship.
Absolutely. And also maintain your current relationships.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's quite the key, right? Because for us, it's not about accumulation of number of followers or connections that have zero results.
It's your 1,000 true fans kind of scenario.
It doesn't have any difference in your actual trajectory in your career.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In this case, it's actually building and maintaining your current professional network and expand based on your objectives, right? Yeah. Your objectives could be, you know, finding a mentor, finding a co-founder, finding anything, you know, it's a dynamic system.
Yeah. Sam, it's been absolutely incredible having you here on the podcast. I mean, I think I say this after every podcast, but we probably could have done another 2 hours or
Let's
two podcasts. Like, at some point, I'm sure we'll get around to it. In the meantime, for our audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where's the best place for them to look for you?
Well, spoiler alert, LinkedIn. Yeah. Actually, like, you know, I've decided a few years back to delete all of my social medias. I think that was a great decision, quite frankly with you. So the only place I am on, which I was forced by my ex-co-founder to jump on board, is LinkedIn. So I'm still on LinkedIn. So if you'd like to find me, it's very simple. You can just put sambenny.com, straight goes to my LinkedIn.
Amazing. Sam, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here with me today.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.